necessarily, theology does talk about practice, about ethics. It talks about politics in the broadest sense, and it always has done. You know, the Bible is an unbelievably political document.
Welcome to The Political Animals. I'm your host, Jonathan Cole. I'm a scholar, writer, and translator who specializes in political theology. Now, hosts of various shows on whatever format often love to say my guest needs no introduction, but my guest really does need no introduction. I'm really pleased to be joined by John Milbank. And if you listen to a show about politics, culture, and theology, you should know who he is. But for those who are just catching up, he is an emeritus professor in the Department of Theology and Religious Studies at the University of Nottingham. I've got a feeling the Brits might say Nottingham, but that sounds like Nottingham for me, but let's not get stuck on.
We would.
Nottingham, is that right, John?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Sorry to all my listeners from Nottingham, not Nottingham. Now, this is according to Wikipedia, because he's a significant enough figure to have a very substantial Wikipedia article, and he can tell me how accurate this is, perhaps. He founded the Radical Orthodox movement, and his work crosses, and I know this is definitely true, disciplinary boundaries, integrating subjects such as systematic theology, social theory, ethics, aesthetics, philosophy, political theory, and political theology, which is what we're going to focus on in this conversation. Is the author of too many books and articles to mention, but he is the author of a genuinely seminal work, which not a lot of authors and thinkers can claim, and that is the book Theology and Social Theory Beyond Secular Reason, and I'm sure that is going to come up at some point in the conversation. So with that, feels like a bit of a brief introduction, John, for someone with a long CV. Welcome to the show.
No, I'm glad that's over with.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, this is not where we were going to start, but I'm always curious with people who have Wikipedia entries, and obviously your name's closely associated with radical orthodoxy.
Yeah.
But I wonder how you react seeing the description, the founder of radical orthodoxy. Is that true? Is that how you think of it?
I'm a co-founder. There were really three of us.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Sorry, I was just always interested in that.
That's fine.
Wikipedia stuff. Now, when I do my intro, I say I'm a scholar of political theology, and I give the very simple definition that it's the intersection between religion and politics. That's just the definition I give to people when I don't have 30 minutes to explain that it's a highly contested term with about 30,000 different definitions and the motley discourse or separate discourses, and you've got Carl Schmitt back in the 20s, and then you've got Metz and Moltmann in the late 60s and 70s, and you've got lots of different perspectives and lots of different ideas and lots of different debate and conflict. We're going to dive into this topic of political theology, and perhaps the definition will come out, although I don't know, John, if you want to, as an opening gambit, say something about the definition, but I actually want to examine the field. And so that it's like going straight through drive-through Maccas and forgetting about the sort of wine before the meal and the nibbles, just to lay my cards on the table. And I've been working on this for the last 9 years. I should have mentioned to you off air, John, just to give you a little bit of background to myself. Yeah. I did my PhD on Oliver O'Donovan. So I don't agree with everything he said.
Very fine thinker.
Absolutely. But sympathetic engagement with his theology of political authority. But even though I depart with him on some matters, I did learn what political theology was through him, and I thought that was a very good, actually, way into political theology. But I just say that at the outset because you might detect that I came into this I don't know, field is even the right word, through the work of Oliver O'Donovan.
I think a quick remark about the term political theology might be useful.
Yes.
Because I think it does get very confused. I mean, I think some of the time it simply means theology of the political law of politics, you know, what theology has to say about politics. And that would be basically, I suppose, what I do. But it is also very much infected by the book Political Theology by Carl Schmitt, mm-hmm. you know, back in 1920. And really what he means by that is something quite adjacent to a kind of sociology of the political. In other mm-hmm. words, just as, you know, Max Weber had talked about Protestantism and capitalism. So in a way, Schmitt was talking about the relationship of the political legacy to theology, and the way this sometimes involved secularized theological concepts. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, a theology of politics is an evaluation by theology. Political theology, as discussed, you know, often very interestingly by people like Giorgio Agamben and so on, is more like a detached investigation of the historical intersection of these two fields and what the continuing implications are for us today, etc.
Yeah, no, that's a helpful and useful distinction. My starting point, which I just want to get on the table, and then I may make a comment about Carl Schmitt, and I'd be interested to get your reaction to my comment.
Yeah,
is that I my 9 years. And I love this field. I love politics. I love theology, and I'm interested in the intersection. But I would contend that it's largely been a failure, and I can get into that because that's complex. But this is my view of Carl Schmitt's political theology, and in particular the discourse that it has generated. So that these are the people, many of them not really religious people, as far as I can tell, who either exegete Carl Schmitt's work or are working on sovereignty or liberal democracy in a discourse that goes back or genealogically has ideas that trace back to the seminal work that Carl Schmitt wrote in the 20s. And that is the use of the term theology for me is so esoteric as to be almost impossible to recognize for anyone that's acquainted with the actual Christian tradition of theology, yes. with its doctrines of the Trinity and the question of providence, yes. and the incarnation and the resurrection. And it's quite, I don't know if musing is, maybe that's belittling it, but it's kind of curious to watch these contemporary scholars trying to understand what Schmitt meant by political theology. And I think they all agree it's quite a difficult work to come to grips with, but he only mentions the term political theology a handful of times. And I think it makes a lot of sense of, as a historical term that describes a historical process. And you mentioned one of his two great ideas. The other one is sovereign is he who decides on the exception, which is the opening line. But that idea that the major political concepts are secularized off political theory are secularized theological concepts. And I can make sense of that as a historical project, looking at, and I can see how you could do a research project trying to test that with the historical sources. But the theology, as people in this particular discourse, including Schmitt, use it, just doesn't seem to mean anything recognizable to someone, say, studying a degree in theology at a seminary or even a theology school in a university. I mean, what do you agree with that, or what's your perspective on that?
Yes, I definitely agree. It seems curiously to ignore the theological scholarship. And even when somebody like Agamben and other Italian writers have tried to bring in far more detail about Christian doctrine, often with tremendous erudition, they nonetheless seem to get some basic things completely wrong, I think. And I find this, the apparent kind of disdain for the actual people doing theology who are within the religion, I think is very dangerous and is misleading them and taking them down incorrect routes, and that they could do the job much better if they interacted with the actual discipline of theology rather better. So yeah, I basically agree with you.
Okay, fascinating. Moving on from Carl Schmitt, because the kind of work I do, and I think the kind of work you do, John, in this area is more what I would call confessional political theology, just to distinguish it from the Schmittian discourse. And by confessional, I don't necessarily mean like I'm Catholic and or I'm Orthodox, but confessing Christians who are trying to approach this intersection as people who take the theological doctrines and ideas seriously, that is, that they might actually say something about reality that we inhabit.
Yes.
Sorry, you look like you're going to say something. So I mean,
there's a sense in which, you know, theology has always tried to have a view on political authority. There's a sense in which theology is all about cosmic order. You know, how could it not be about politics? And at that point, I think Agamben says something useful, that somehow theology is always at the intersection of metaphysics, or what is the structure of being, on the one hand, and the issue of divine government on the other hand, that we live, as it were, within a cosmic polity. Mm-hmm. So there's a sort of politicization of philosophy, if you like, that is already there in somebody like Plato, but perhaps made more explicit in Christianity when you have the idea of a personal God. And then conversely, the Christian thinking about politics is very much imbued with metaphysical or ontological categories. Mm. It's the whole question of natural law, which, if you like, simply means how does God govern the universe and how do we fit within the government of God? Mm-hmm. Involves the question of what is reality like, and how should the potency of politics, to put it in a slightly Schellingian way, the kind of the aspect of reality or the mode of reality that is politics, how should it reflect the metaphysical order, or try to be true to that metaphysical order, which involves an attempt to perform that order and not just sort of see that order. But there's a sense in which, you know, how we act and how we see things are always intertwined, such that there is a kind of political aspect in the end to our metaphysics. You know, where are things going? Where should they go? That there's a sort of ideal aspect to how we observe reality. And then conversely, if politics is all about action, what we should do, where we should be going, that can't ignore, the nature of reality, if you like. So to put this very simply, it's always about how we match reality and ideality, I think.
And I suppose a corollary of that is that a theology has nothing to say about the political is in some sense deficient, because it should.
Yeah, theology. Version,
that should be in the theology. Yes,
I mean, I suppose part of what I've always fought against in my career is any idea that theology is about some sort of narrow segment of reality and just has to fit into everything else. You know, for one thing, this is a death wish. You know, if theologians don't talk about also as philosophers, and remembering that the whole term Christian theology is historically a relatively recent one, you know, to be very simple, the Christian theologian simply is a Christian philosopher. Mm. And unless we have the same ambition and scope as philosophy, we won't really be listened to. But for another thing, you know, theology, because it's an attempt to think impossibly, but inevitably, from the point of view of the absolute. You know, if everything derives from God, however we want to think about God, if it derives from the source of reality, the absolute reality, which we, you know, we in some sense can't avoid thinking about. And so ultimately, you know, most of the time we're talking about particular areas and how things are. But philosophy and theology have to be about how everything joins up, and also about the origins of everything. So the mystery of how things are is ultimately to do with how they have come to be, with their genealogy, even if how they come to be includes something unanticipated in what eventuates. The deep question of the nature of things is always to do with where they're from and where they're going. So it's a question of origins. And I think a lot of modern theology, you know, has become more and more professionalized, you know, confined to things like how do we argue for God's existence, the problem of evil, how do we sort of certify revelation in historical terms? And then you get different bits doing. And to me, none of this is theology as the fathers would have understood it, or Aquinas would have understood it. Theology necessarily has to take a view of the whole, you know, and to try to do that is of course impossible. It looks like a kind of vaunting, and academics typically pretend not to approve of that sort of thing, you know, and they pretend to be very humble, which is usually a sort of mask for the arrogance of thinking they know everything there is to be known about a particular area. But the real humility is nonetheless to try to do that, because if we don't try to do that, then we're betraying our civilizational and cultural task, which is allied to an enterprise of trying to hold everything together. So necessarily, theology does talk about practice, about ethics. It talks about politics in the broadest sense, and it always has done. You know, the Bible is an unbelievably political document. Jesus clearly has a novel view about politics, even if it's curiously going beyond politics in some way, or putting politics in perspective. That in itself is a very radical political view that is similar and yet different, maybe, to the move that Socrates and Plato has taken. And a brilliant book, recent book by David Dusenbury, talks about the sheer degree to which, from outside, when Jesus was talked about in early antiquity, outside Christianity, he is always linked to these philosopher figures who are saying dangerous things in the city and get executed. You know, so there's a political dimension to Christianity from the outset, and the church itself, you know, described itself somewhat in political terms. For ecclesia, the governing assembly of the city, for example. And the church is a very strange organization that is sort of somehow fusing the academy, the cultus, the polity, all together in a unique kind of way. And claiming to be a universal association, you know, claiming in some sense to be world governments, you know, we can't get away from that. And therefore, you know, ecclesiology is in itself, if you like, a very political matter. Mm. I mean, a curious fact which people don't reflect on perhaps enough, and which I really don't fully understand, is that, you know, ecclesiology as a separate theological subject. Didn't really arrive on the scene for a long time. But I tend to think that's because people, you know, and really right from the outset, started to think in thought in terms of sort of Christianization of the whole society, in terms of Christendom, in fact, taken in a certain sense, such that there wasn't a sort of separate thinking about the church. There was rather a thinking, about the entire social political order. For example, in Aquinas, it seems to me that's why he doesn't have a separate. And nor does Aquinas ever say, as people said later, that the church in itself is a sort of perfect self-sufficient society. In other words, even though it is kind of the ultimate political society, for now, it's the city of God and the city of this world are hopelessly tangled up with each other. So in that sense, all the more, impossible to talk about the church without talking about society and about politics, if you like. And then, just another final remark on this one. I think there's a sense in which, for most of its history, Christianity has been about sort of pointing the finite towards the infinite, if you like. And I think that, the sort of the early German romantics and idealists, people like Hölderlin, were kind of right to say that in a sense, you've got to see Christ as like the last God. In other words, there've been lots and lots of manifestations of the divine in all sorts of gods, all sorts of epiphanies and oracles. But now we have, the absolute arrival of God himself as a human being, that the final, the final manifestation of God, and therefore it's all over, if you like. The infinite has become finite. The task from now on is to infinitize the finite, or to put it in more traditional terms, the point of the incarnation then is our deification. Sort of God has gone down, we're now going up. And yet, and I think there is a sort of as yet about this, I think the Romantics started to worry that thereby we'd sort of, first of all, that we kind of lost the pagan too much, a sort of celebration of nature and politics and sex and so on. But also that in losing the pagan too much, we're somehow not, we're sort of one-sidedly relating to the incarnation. In other words, that, okay, after the final manifestation of God, we're infinitizing the finite. But does that mean the process of incarnation has simply stopped? And if we look back at the fathers, and actually particularly at Augustine, who the core of his work is commentary on the Psalms, where he talks about the Christus Totus, and that's the church, suggests very strongly that, because, absolute truth is not just finite to infinite, but infinite to finite, continuing. They're the same thing. That we've got to also think in terms of a continuing incarnation. In other words, a continuing manifestation, permeation of the divine into the human. And it seems to me that a lot of the 19th century, and I'm more and more convinced that maybe we have to go back to the 19th century to see things clearly. A lot of the 19th century Christian thought, and actually particularly Anglican Christian thought, was focused on the incarnation before terrible evangelicals wrecked everything, as they continue to do so. And it was about the further incarnating of the Christian order in society, in marital relations, in arts. And so, for example, something like John Ruskin, you get sort of more and more this sense that, theology is done by working and art and not just anything else. And we see this very much in sort of Russian thought as well. In other words, now the idea we're going upwards is also the idea we're going continue to go outwards and downwards, and in keeping with Paul saying, in the end, Christ will be all in all. And I think this continuing incarnating project, makes politics all the more important. Mm. In other words, in the face of kind of the horrors of the Industrial Revolution and the way that led to the ill treatment of children, and of course the ill treatment of other races and all kinds of things, that people said, this isn't Christianity. Christianity has to be much more concerned with this world, and after all, life in time has to mean something. It can't be just a sort of prelude to individuals going to heaven. The New Testament fulfills, but it doesn't abandon the Jewish perspective of the Old Testament. We're still, our life in time, in some obscure sense, is building up the kingdom to come. That it somehow matters to the final apocalyptic. And I think in Russian thinkers like Solovyov, this is very, very much to the fore. So for that reason as well, I think that a political theology has become a more decisive part of theology.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I want to tell you now a political theology story. This is going to be quite different and more pessimistic, and then we'll try and bring them together. Because I'm not going to contest any of that. I'm going to lay out some more context that I think political theology has to grapple with, and then you can respond to that, and we can work our way through. And this goes to that failure point that I alluded to. And of course, there are honourable exceptions to this. I'm not suggesting, and I'm engrossed by the field, so I'll explain what I mean by. Well, maybe I have to explain by what I mean by failure, but let me point out a couple of things. And you touch on this in Theology and Social Theory and other work. So there comes a point in time historically where the Christian lens through which politics is understood recedes, and non-Christian thinkers start to dominate our whole conception of how we think about politics. You get the emergence of political science, which you talk about in that book. We start to distinguish political theology from political philosophy. We start to think of politics becomes professionalized. So now you can have a career as a politician or in politics. Perhaps you're a political journalist. You write a blog. You're a political commentator. You can be a political activist. And so this realm is carved out of both professional action, thought, communication, and the Christian voices get marginalized. And then partly as a response, Christians start to think like these non-Christians, and they say, okay, I've got my church here. How do I interact with the political, like it's some alien domain completely separate from the church? Or I'm a Christian and I'm concerned about this thing happening in society, or I want prayer in schools, or I'm against the death penalty. How can I operate effectively in the political arena? And so they go again to the non-Christian experts, and this is how you communicate, this is how you build a policy, this is how you raise money. And so when I look at political theology now, notwithstanding the sort of approach you have, and many, many others have different approaches like that, There's this whole other field which creates enormous social anxiety, and it's got to do with cultural changes and the position of the church, particularly in Western democracies, changing a lot. And the other thing I think that happens is, and perhaps this is subtle, perhaps not so subtle, Christians start to become very influenced by what I would call secular or non-Christian political ideas without necessarily knowing it. So you've got conservative Christians who work with non-Christian conservatives. You've got sort of progressive Christians who have an agenda that often looks indistinguishable from the left-wing atheist. And I kind of look at this and think, how is it possible that the church has kind of become factionalized, but those factions look to be determined a lot by developments in thought and political trends happening outside of the church? And the church now looks for its political guidance to the political commentators, the politicians, the prominent secular political theorists or journalists or the like. And so I wonder, this is one reason why I think political theology has failed. And I can, let me give you one anecdote. So I went to a Senate inquiry some years ago here in Canberra. It was on national identity and something like that. So there's a big group of scholars, professors, political scientists, think tanks, people working on every aspect of this, that, and the other. And I sit down next to a young political science who actually does some pretty good work as far as political science. And this is something perhaps we could get into, because I actually think there's a lot I like about political science, because it's very methodologically aware. And it's not that there aren't methodological problems, but the methodological discussion, which is completely absent in confessional political theology, is useful. And I realize I'm bouncing all over the place, because it forces you to think about, okay, how can we say something? How can we be sure? How do we even test political reality or say something that's reliably descriptive about it? Anyway, she works on this big national survey that's taken after every federal election in Australia, and we could quibble about the methodology, but the good thing is that they can derive trends over time and look at trust in government, all that kind of stuff. Anyway, I sit next to her as this inquiry is about to start, and she asks what I do, and I say political theology, and there's this quizzical look, and she says, what's that? And of course, then I have to try and explain to this person who's working at one of Australia's most prestigious universities in political science. She just had no conception that theology was in any way relevant. So failure one is we have a great discourse as Christians, but no one that seems to me is listening. And we're no longer, and you know this, this is one of the points in theology and social theory as I understand it. I mean, once you give up the meta discourse, being the sort of meta discourse, and you push to the margin, and we could do the most superb political theology in our little rarefied circles, but the politicians aren't listening to us. The political activists aren't. No one's teaching our stuff in political science departments, and they don't even know we exist. And I don't think we often even know how to talk to them. And then a related piece to that is that, and definitely present company is accepted here, a lot of political theology today lacks originality. And again, it's that particular influence. It's like, how can I justify my conservative politics with a couple of Bible verses or looking at Jesus, or how can I commandeer Jesus to my particular revolutionary cause, ignoring half of the things that's in the Bible because it's dialectic and that's what actually makes it really interesting? And there's that method question. Now, not everything, you know, you can get obsessed with methodology, and social scientists tie themselves in knots, and the methodology becomes so rigorous that you end up saying nothing interesting often. But it would be nice to me if we could at least ask those epistemological questions. You know, what are we actually talking about when we talk about politics and theology? And how could we set up a discourse where we may be actually able to convince each other with all of our competing ideas that actually this is true and reliable? And then the last one is politics, whatever it is. And I'm not entirely sure. This is part of my own intellectual struggle of how to, I think like you in terms of politics has to fit within some totalizing ontology and cosmic reality with God as creator. And like, I like that point you made about origins. So what is the origin of what we call politics? Even if we've carved out a slice of reality and we've decided we're studying this and we're talking about this, but the thing that I find difficult, and see, one piece of background about me is I worked for the federal government for 13 years in Canberra in a range of departments. And I originally did study political history and then some political science and then went into theology. I was a Christian throughout the whole time. And so I came in with a very strong knowledge of how political institutions operate, how law works, how that sort of Russell, that rough and tumble of politics operates. And I then go into political theology. I'm thinking often, what are these theologians talking about? It's like they don't actually know what how laws are made and how political parties operate and the whole system. And so there's a kind of lack of empiricism. And I know you can go too much into empiricism, but if you know anything about political science, they're very focused on the empirical. Which is why you don't ask them meaning questions, because they're completely clueless. Like, you know, the survey says this. Well, what is politics? Well, you know, that they're hopeless on that kind of stuff. And so they're, in a way, my gripes and grievances and why I say political theology. Perhaps I should rephrase it, not say political theology is a failure, but that it's failing, as in failing to do what I think and want it to do. And perhaps we're on a unity ticket there. I'm not sure.
No, you've raised so many issues, but I really agree with everything you've said entirely. It is depressing for me the way in which, I mean, not only is Christianity in many places declining, I mean, at different speeds, but the Christians that are left seem so often half-hearted and only half to understand what it is that they're doing, the faith they belong to, and to so much define themselves in terms of basically secular attitudes. You know, after all, we're up against something horrendously powerful, you know, and it's only got more powerful through the mobile phone, etc. And this is particularly true in politics, that, you know, the space where people, you know, really ask themselves what would be a Christian approach is very small. As you say, they tend to use Christianity selectively to underwrite what they're doing. And we lack a sort of political inquiry which would say, well, hold on, there's only been right and left for about 200 years. You know, it sprang up in a post-Christian context. You know, are we completely clear that we can understand a Christian approach to politics in standard right-wing or left-wing terms? And you know, we lack that kind of investigation. And then when we do get people claiming to be enacting some sort of Christian politics, then, as you say, this seems to be too narrowly focused on a certain set of issues. You know, they can be worried about certain cultural tendencies in relation to life, death, bioengineering, sex, gender, and so forth. Or they can be very worried about religious liberty. And I sort of resonate with all that. But I think the attempt to create a politics out of this is very, very dangerous, especially if that sort of then allies itself with populist. You sort of fill in the gaps by allying that with populist racism and nationalism, and then you're sort of indifferent about the way you do the economy, And if anything, you'll be inclined to support capitalism because operating in a capitalist way to get lots of money for your culture wars causes is what naturally suggests itself to you. And this is my strong objection to the whole National Conservative thing, and their conference is happening in Britain at the moment. You know, despite the fact that they're raising, rightly, some themes that don't get raised, particularly about what is happening to young people in all sorts of ways. They can't afford to have babies. Yes, 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 I agree with that. But somehow, with some honourable exceptions, the focus is just too narrow. It's not all-rounded. It's too much simply about partisan and party politics. And the attempts of people coming out of radical orthodoxy has always been not that, but to try to reshape the whole mood of politics. You know, so the Hayekian movement managed to do that. You know, basically Thatcher, Clinton, Blair and Reagan were all in fundamental agreement. You know, there are marginal differences. Before that, you know, we had a Tory prime minister who could say, well, I am a sort of socialist. You know, nobody booed. and you know, as a child of the 50s, we can't repeat the 50s, but in some ways, I would like to do it again differently. Because it was a much more egalitarian era, and it put the common good at the center. So the children of radical orthodoxy sort of tried to change the whole political discourse and to get together the Christians on both, you know, the more reflective Christians who are MPs or the equivalent in other countries actually sometimes are trying to think in rather more Christian terms and have a lot in common across the parties. And we tried to some extent to build with that. And you got so-called red Toryism and blue Labour and so on, which were, roughly speaking, attempts to have a communitarian politics, you know, a more egalitarian and common good approach to economics, a sort of gentle social conservatism, a sort of paradoxical combination of more democratic participation with an understanding of the role of tradition and educative hierarchy and the need for the idea that a wise few and popular contributions to our understanding somehow are dialectically symbiotic, that this kind of set of attitudes, you know, what you might call mixed government. And by the way, the new book by Patrick Deneen is very much going, as I hear, to kind of support that sort of thing. But I would have to say that, you know, we got so far, but, you know, up to this point, again, maybe you would have to say, so far this has failed. Even if the story is not over, you know, what we have now instead, it seems, is a lot of disaffected young people migrating to the populist right, and a kind of confusion of what I want to call post-liberalism with something like national conservatism. And you know, an excessive stress upon the nation that is completely unrealistic. You know, the era when we had strong governments after the war was also linked to certain very powerful international arrangements, you know, like Bretton Woods, underwritten by the United States, you know. So, and today we have very, very powerful civilization states that remain actually very ideological. So I don't accept the analysis that simply says, oh, the nation state has come back, even though, you know, a stronger role for the nation state may be part of the mixture we need. I don't deny that. But I don't think it's as simple as that, nor do I think it's enough to say, as some people on the left are sort of saying, well, liberal idealism failed with the Iran war and so on. We're now into a kind of tragic realism of sort of balance of powers and competing powers. Again, an element of truth in that, but I also feel as if it's too simple. That neither China or the US are going to be content with a balance of powers. There is still a huge ideological question about what China and Russia stand for and what they're trying to impose upon other people. The question of political Islam and, wonderful things about Islam, but Islamism is problematic, and the politicization of Islam, just to a lesser extent, as we're saying, the politicization of Christianity is also problematic. These are all problematic. But I don't think that these ideological dimensions have simply vanished. And to some extent, I resonate with a recent speech by one of Biden's advisors in which he said, well, look, what we're trying to do is kind of build up American industrial policy, but in a way that will be joined up with interventionist industrial policies by other countries. And we're not trying, a lot of what China is doing in Africa is very exploitative, as well as trying to pull them away from democracy. And what this suggests is, America hasn't given up. It maybe it's no longer trying to impose the same liberal democratic model on everybody. Mm-hmm. And we shouldn't do that. But, the rule of law matters, and people's material and spiritual flourishing and freedom matters. And I think we need a better and deeper sense of what it means to belong to the Western tradition. That it's not just about negative freedom and technocracy. It's about the value of the person and the common good, and indeed trying to reflect the absolute in time. Up till yesterday, we were entirely religious. We need to recover this religious legacy that comes to us from the Greeks and the Romans, as well as from the Jews. It's only kind of the pseudo scholarship of sort of something like, the Oxford Literae Humaniores tradition that wants to somehow elide all the religion and the metaphysics from the classical world, as if these were all kind of nice humanists and so on. No, the entire legacy is religious, I think. And, we've exported the worst of the West to the rest of the world, if you like, so that what we're now facing in the case of China is a horrible sort of Marxist capitalist hybrid. It's not
the worst of both worlds.
it's a terrible version of it. It's as if we've excreted our culture, and this orgy is coming towards us. And so, the idea that the ideal dimension is simply over. I totally agree that Blair and Bush shamefully neglected reality. So we're on your empirical point. Yeah. It's not a responsible idealism. It's not even idealism if we neglect empirical reality and what is possible. I think so. Again, one thematic for me this morning is this bringing of the real and the ideal together. Is, I think, absolutely essential. But, how do we make any inroads whatsoever with, recovering a Christian outlook when, Christianity is in such trouble? Well, I think one key to that is that we have to show why Christianity makes, a practical difference. So we have to have this more total concern. I think another thing to say, which may seem harsh, is that once a culture has kind of lost its unconscious continuity, it has to be deliberately recovered. you know, so that recovering Christianity from the bottom upwards is perhaps not seriously possible. You know, for one thing, it involves the ability to read the Bible, and most people are losing the ability to read.
Full stop.
You know, necessarily, to some extent, that any renewal will come from the top and will come from minorities, because, as I think, you know, Ratzinger has anticipated, it can't really happen any other way. There has to be a very deliberate, conscious, and educated recovery of a Christian culture. But then, you know, how do we do that? And I think, you know, one reason for failure, if you like, is that all the time we're up against money, you know, that secular forces have all the funding. Mm. And within religion, evangelicals, conservative evangelicals, you know, or the wrong kind of evangelicals often have all the money, or Catholic conservatives have an enormous amount of money. And again, these are people who've somehow politicized Christianity. They've turned it into a set of issues. It's not deeply rooted enough. And, you know, therefore the problem for you and me and our sort of, I hope, more rounded outlook is how do we obtain sort of the funding to do anything more serious and alternative, you know? And I think all I can suggest here is that probably we need to explore the possibilities of doing things, you know, as cheaply as with small amount of resources, because it seems to me there are a lot of human resources. There's a lot of human capital, or if you like, but a lot of people with our kinds of thoughts, but they're dispersed, and it's mm-hmm. how to bring them together. We need more strategic thinking, you know, maybe from political experts. How do we organize? How do we be effective? Especially because mm-hmm. probably the kind of social vision that we have would be attractive to most people. It's just that no political force ever represents this. It's always squeezed out of the picture.
And I don't, I mean, I think that's a very pertinent point about the money, particularly in this world and this kind of neoliberal economic paradigm that we all live in. I suppose if in the absence of money, you're really looking at dedication and sacrifice. So the virtues you've got to work with, which then means you have to persuade people. But I was thinking then, John, that there is an opportunity for Christians here, because I think this kind of vision that ditches the extremities on both the left and right and comes up with something that's novel but also traditional, because I think that's the key mix here, and I saw strands from both in there, that and something new that breaks out of the existing polarized paradigm. I don't see the energy or ideas in the secular world to do that, because here's an interesting idea. The thinker I've done a lot of work on, and a friend of mine, Christos Yanaras, and I mentioned to you off air, I've just translated.
Oh, yes. I met Yanaras and his son about 3 years ago. Well, it was before the pandemic, I think.
I just translated a recent book he wrote in 2019 called On the Meaning of Politics. It's only a short little
essay. So you can speak modern Greek. That's good.
I can, yeah. I'm married to a Greek woman, and I started studying Greek like 20 plus years ago, so it's been that's a whole part of long my life. Yes. But he's got this really interesting idea that our politics is really shaped by our perceptions or misperceptions or distortions of reality. And it just struck me, I think there's a resonance here between your thought and Christos's, in the sense that
definitely,
we convinced ourselves that all those concepts you're talking about that I like, the absolute, the infinite, These have absolutely nothing to do with politics. So we have consciously reduced, in a very reductionist sense, our political vision to something very pragmatic and practical and a contest of power and things like money. And we're forced to think about that because we live within that universe. And so in a way, you know, what I get from Christos that I think is relevant here is this idea that we have created a political reality and then convinced ourselves that that's politics. But it's a result of certain changes in our thinking and our ethics, our anthropology. And in a way, from this Christian perspective, and I imagine you may well agree to this, that we're living in this kind of perverted political reality that's completely – it's like the city – that has obscured the stars because there's too much light and smog. And so if you inhabited that universe forever, you may never know that there's a cosmos out there.
No. It reminds me of Lewis's The Silver Chair. But yes, I think that's right. We're kind of completely perverse that, you know, how does political order arise in the first place? What is the origins of political order? It's a mystery, and it's always conceived as something sacred. This is why the figure of the king is so usually central in some way or other. He's a kind of shamanic figure. You know, our tendency now is to say, well, people baptize and ideologically justify human order by invoking the sacred and the gods. And this is seen as a sophisticated view rather than a naive view. I would say it's an incredibly naive view. It's the most possibly naive view. You know, because it's not that we first have order and then it's seen as sacred. It's that from the outset, it arrives as something sacral, as something mysterious. And if you want to say that this is our fantasy, you're left with all sorts of completely imponderable questions. You know, why do we have this fantasy? You know, why don't we just have a kind of normal, regular animal existence? You know, why do we think our existence is questionable? Why has nature thrown up this weird naked species that needs words and tools which are not natural but artificial, even to survive as natural? The kind of question that somebody like Leroy Gourin or Teilhard de Chardin rightly raised. How come artifice can be natural unless somehow it is sacred, unless the sacral is precisely this kind of fusion of the natural and the artificial, just as our language is a kind of natural utterance. You know, it's sort of continuous with our breath, and yet it's also something, it's entirely conventional. You know, so it's as if language fuses art and nature, art and culture. And unless we construe this in some profoundly metaphysical way, unless we suppose that these are aspects of the absolute, if you like, you know, how do we make any sense of this whatsoever without kind of implausibly arguing away everything significant about our humanity? And so, you know, I think, you know, the serious ethnographic thinkers from sort of Vico and the French Jesuits in Latin America, or indeed the Spanish Jesuits in Latin America onwards, correctly recognized that the origins of human society lie in some kind of recognition of the sacred as demanding an ethical order, demanding that we behave in certain ways, because these are kind of absolute and cosmic in some sense. And the political authority is weirdly grounded in a certain obeisance or act of humility towards what you're serving, and includes suffering. So it was incredible that nobody, very few people, could any longer understand the coronation of Charles the Third, where he looked like this almost Shakespearean victim figure. And everybody said, why isn't he doing a big Hollywood smile? Why not? Why? But because he's suffering. Because he knows he's 75. He's in a terrible role. This is his destiny. He can't escape it. It's a, you know, it's a completely solemn reality. But he is the core. He is the symbol. He is the reminder of that our our human exercise of authority is somehow answerable, answerable beyond time, you know. And if it's not answerable, then how is there any ethics? How is there any justice beyond something like mere convenience? So, you know, I thought quite brilliantly they added to the ceremony this child saying, I'm a child of God. I greet you in the name of the King of Kings. You know, so you're only king because you're subservient to the King of Kings. And, you know, how else do we guarantee kind of the limitation of our politics?
It's the coronation was so interesting because there hasn't been one for so long. It's the first one of my lifetime. And so it's the first one I've ever watch.
This is its antiquity was kind of like much more shocking than in 1952, I think.
Yeah. Well, the thing that really struck me, which shouldn't have surprised me, but then again, it's not like this happens every Tuesday, was just how profoundly religious and Christian it was. Because I'm in this context in Australia, which is probably not too dissimilar from the UK, where lots of Christians, it's kind of funny. I'm connected to both the conservative Christian world and the more progressive Christian world, and they both have the same lament.
I probably have too.
No one wants to hear from us. We're under siege. No one cares what Christians think. They don't. They're either want to attack us, or we're embarrassed and ashamed of all the things we've done wrong. How do we engage? They're both desperate to engage and find some kind of relevance. And so you have all these discussions, we don't want to lose the Lord's Prayer at the opening of Parliament, and someone else, we don't want to lose religious education. And then here's this coronation that is so overtly, explicitly harks back to the kind of world you're talking about, I think, John, where it's just taken for granted that this is a solemn religious ceremony. And you're so right about that observation that King Charles really, he looked burdened. Like, there was something enormous. I've heard some Americans try to sort of work out how this fits into their Hollywood universe, but it was very anti-Hollywood in a way, in that he almost looked not terrified, but in awe of the gravity of the situation. And it struck me because this was so bizarre, because it just cut through this secular world we used to be in. And it was funny listening to the Australian commentators trying to make sense of this religious language and religious ceremony held in this magnificent
building. The church just didn't do a very good job of trying to explain all that. You know, where was the material going to Sunday schools? You know, this is, for kids, a completely magical event. So, you know, why is the church not seizing that opportunity? There's an incredible lack of imagination and doing the seriously obvious. And, you know, this is because somehow secularization has crept into the core of the church itself. And I think it harkens back to something I was saying about how for so much of Christian history we've if you like, tried to elevate and that has sometimes had a consequence of disenchanting this world. Whereas now I think we have to re-enchant the world. You know, we have to, you know, Christianity succeeded initially in an enchanted pagan universe. We have to sort of re-enchant the world in Christian terms. And I think this is, you know, this is what, you know, probably the Inklings, Tolkien and Lewis and Williams and Barfield, this is probably what they understood more than anybody else. And I think it's no accident that their stuff has been, you know, so wildly popular. Mm. Or even the final profoundly religious book of the Harry Potter sequence, it seems to me, does a rather similar thing, you know. And we need more of the myth and the magic, actually, if we're to get through to people. And instead of that, we've got this sort of warpedly austere politicization, you know. We're either banging on and on about perfectly worthy sort of social justice causes overseas on one hand, or about indeed cultural anxieties on the other hand. But these are too one-sided. They're not deeply rooted. They're not enough linked to offering people, you know, something profoundly positive. You know, so another thing that I worry about with the kind of national conservative thing is, you know, how are we going to talk about, you know, serious economic ways in which people can aspire to have marriage and family and children and combine work and family in the future? You know, how do we have an account of that and the needs of most people in that respect? You know, it's too negative, I think.
No, I agree with that. I think, what do you make, John, of this notion that all of the weird, wacky, wonderful, but also terrifying new cultural trends, from identity politics to the recrudescence of nationalism, populism, so a mix of old and new, depending if you think it's kind of new ideas or notions, all being streams that ultimately go back to the disappearance or the loss of cultural capital or power or influence of the church and Christianity. Is that too simplistic, do you think? I'm just curious, because this is a big idea. I wrestle with it myself, because I think you can certainly link some things. I just don't know if you can.
Yeah,
such a broad canvas here. Because
I think you know, that's a proper caution on your part. But I think, you know, humans don't live by bread alone, and so when they lose religion, there's an emotional vacuum, and we've already seen abundantly how that tends to get filled by nationalism. And much as I value nationalism and patriotism, I worry about nationalism on either the left or the right, you know. And too often, you know, we've had sort of pagan nationalism, but now we seem to have quasi-Christian nationalism. And often on the right. But in the case of the Basque Country or of Ireland, and actually on both sides of the religious divide, interestingly, you've also had a kind of nationalism on the left, whether this is Irish nationalism or British nationalism, because a little known fact is that the Unionist terrorists thought of themselves as being on the political left. It's a remarkable fact. So, what we have here is, you know, in the case of Irish republicanism or Basque nationalism, you know, often, you know, the priests turning a blind eye to murder, and an excessive linking of Christianity to a nationalist cause. I'm just reading the last novel, Thomas Nevinson, by Javier, Javier Marias, the Spanish novelist who died of COVID. And you can tell his absolute loathing for Franco and so on. And yet in this book, he has a kind of equal loathing for Basque and Irish republicanism when it's prepared to turn to violence, you know, and, you know, the questionableness perhaps of their causes, you know, the excessive obviousness of the idea that Basque should be a country, or that Ireland should be necessarily completely disjoined from the whole of the rest of this peninsula. The excessive obviousness of that, and that kind of the turning to violence, and, you know, the dangers of Scottish nationalism now. So that exists on the left, but you know, more predominantly, it exists on the right, where, you know, there are some good things in Hungary and Poland regarding families and things, no doubt, but there's also an excessive nationalism, even though I think Ukraine has qualified that heavily in the case of Poland. And what on earth does nationalism mean when it comes to something like the United States, which is inherently a federation? Yeah. It's a federation of different states and different ethnicities and different cultures. You know, one's fear is whenever they start talking about nationalism, they really mean white nationalism. You know, it has, you know, the fear there of some kind of lurking racism, and to me this is kind of post-Christian. We're forgetting that Christianity is an international order, an international polity in some sense. It doesn't mean that it's kind of encouraging literal world government, but it's certainly encouraging international cooperation. And in a globalized world, how do we, you know, there only disorder follows if we don't have kind of international legal structures and agreements in which as many people as possible are participating. So, you know, I think this kind of post-Brexit idea that you can't have democracy beyond the level of the nation state is a name for despair. If we can't, we're in deep trouble. You know, if we can't in some sense do that, you know, we will just be kind of controlled by power and money. So I'm going slightly off the point here, but I think I would worry that nationalism is the result of certainly the post-religious. It needn't be just the post-Christian, but certainly the post-religious. And I think similarly with many forms of identity politics, that people, you know, the default line is that, you know, an individual should decide, you know, an individual should craft their own lives. But what we've got is a kind of bastard romanticism. You know, the romantics still believed in organic order and communities and doing things together and collaborating and becoming a personal person through relations. It's clear if you read their writings. But what we now have is a sort of commercialized Nietzsche or something, you know, that we're all supposed to be. But you know, that's too fearful a prospect. So in reality, what individualism means is a more and more ferocious reduction of yourself to a claimed identity. You know, if you're associating with a real community, something like a religion or you're a culture, you know, you can develop individual personality. But today, no, people say, I am gay and that's the whole of me, or I am transsexual and that's the whole of me, or I am a, you know, I am a kind of white man recovering my warlike masculinity or something, and that's the whole of me, and this is an increasing tendency, and particularly teenagers. This victimizes teenagers. They're vulnerable. They're developing, and you know, a quick defensive thing to do is to adopt this identity, just as people tattoo their whole bodies. It's very similar. These are fashions, and like, you know, transsexuality, of course, a few people are, but on the whole, what we're seeing here is something parallel to anorexia. It's a mode of distress. Sometimes it's people who are, for the moment, gay or are always going to be gay. Who knows? You know, who knows? And I, you know, the gay community is rightly very worried about the medicalization of these kind of phenomena in teenagers. And then, of course, yeah, on top of that, you've got the breakdown of any sense that there are kind of natural kinds and essences. You know, even if, as I've already said, as human beings, we're uniquely developing and discovering who we are, nonetheless, sort of denying biological limits, or that there are implications of how we're supposed to go in the way we are, that we have male and female bodies, and so on. You know, the technocracy combined with the sort of liberal absolute cult of the choosing will means a will to sort of completely remake nature, if you like, you know. And I think, as there's a recent book coming out, I forget its name, it's going to argue this, but the, you know, technocratic drives seem to be always initially things that exalt the rich and powerful, that they seize them and make use of them. And I think that this is the case here, that people will see huge amounts of money to be made. They already do out of the transsexual thing. People see huge amounts of money to be made out of the idea that we can totally transform or even escape our bodies. And there is, if you like, a sort of neo-Gnostic, if that's fair, hatred of the body arising. And, you know, the same book argues that after a while, we see the need to sort of qualify the effects of technocracy. We saw the effect, you know, the need to qualify the effects of the Industrial Revolution.
Yeah.
And I think, similarly, we're going to see the need to qualify our ability to simply change the way we are. You know, we can be absolutely certain that if we escape too far from our animality, disaster will follow, because, you know, we are, after all, part of a natural world. We're designed to, you know, there are going to be limits to how far, just as we're discovering, there are limits to how far we can sort of rearrange nature without kind of unforeseen consequences. So I think also there is a human ecology that we have to observe. And I think the more people realize that, and I think they're already realizing, you know, that the people who benefit from this kind of extreme biotechnocracy are actually powerful elites who are going to survey everything we do, try and manipulate us, keep us passive, you know, then we'll need a sort of popular rebellion against that. But as with your question about Christian action, you know, there's some reason for pessimism here, because you know, increasingly so many people are kind of pacified and tranquilized. You know, it's not like people in factories in the past where they had to work bloody hard, but they had the energy to rebel because of that.
Yeah.
But nowadays it's as if everybody's on drugs, and indeed, a lot of people in American small towns are literally on drugs. Yeah, yeah. They're on opioids. They're kind of kept quiescent. So, yeah. You know, where
it's more like Brave New World, and where we're kind of just
yes. Far more like Brave New World than 1984.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's interesting because I'm just reflecting that there's a wicked dilemma here, I think, because the temptation, and this is a temptation that most Christians, I think, succumb to, is to fight the battle in the political arena as it is defined by the non-Christian world, which is then to make some pretty serious concessions. And you saw this back in 1990 when you published Theology and Social Theory, that once theology concedes its place as a meta discourse, then it's going to be defined by all these yeah. new discourses that get carved out of theology. Yeah. And then before you know it, you're on the margin. And then, you know, just recollecting our earlier conversation, the sort of very narrow, discrete focus of theology now as a discipline where you study a bit of ethics and you do a bit of systematic theology and it's all carved up, that's a very secular idea, isn't it? That you go do a degree, you do a bunch of disciplines, and you could come out with that knowing nothing about politics or science or management yeah. or history yeah. even. That's not the history of the church. You're not going to know anything about China or yes. the Aztecs, for yeah. example. And so it makes me... And this is another reason why I think political theology is failing as a project, because Christians are trying to do it in a very applied way of, I'm going to get elected. We need a Christian political party. We need a Christian yes. activist group here, and we've got to raise enough funds to...
No, this is absolutely right. And I think, you know, this is why theology is probably a bad first degree subject. You know, I think that what we need, and... the United States has this far more than we do in Britain, is, you know, we need all round first degrees. They should last a minimum of 4 years, but for a far smaller minority of people, most people should be in doing vocational degrees leading to jobs. Mm. But for the minority of more academic approach, we need a, you know, not that I'd remove the academic altogether from most people, but, you know, I think it's a small number of people who need to be totally focused on that. But I think, yeah, they need to do all-round things involving humanities as well as the sciences. You know, they need a good general grounding in classics, history, literature, and so on, you know, before you even approach theology. And then that needs to be something like, you know, another 5 years. Of course, the funding difficulties. But maybe we do it in a different way, you know, who yeah. knows? But that's another issue. But, you know, then theology needs to be conceived much more, I think, you know, as an integral study. For reasons I've said that, and you know, it needs to be really all about God. You know, church history should ultimately be about what is the action of providence in history, and as you say, it should be joined to the question of universal history. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. and I was wondering recently, you know, how come the German Romantics and then the Russians of the Silver Age, they were the last Renaissance men. And, it, you know, we keep on saying, well, there's too much knowledge now for anybody to do that. But I just don't believe it, because there's always been too much knowledge. Mm. It's only relative. It is a question of our approach and our lack of focus on people who make syntheses or creating canons of books that everybody... needs to read. You know, we lack an integrating all-round culture. And this is why I've always agreed with Luigi Giussani in The Risk of Education, that, you know, that a lot of our education is psychologically damaging, because human beings are naturally asking, how does this all put together? Mm-hmm. You know, and unless our education is sort of imbued with philosophy in that sense, it's not really education, and it can't generate the right kind of bildung or formation or the right kind mm-hmm. of culture. And so, you know, the issue is, how do we shift all that? I mean, at least, you know, the people writing this sort of secular political theology, they, you know, 20, 30 years ago, there was a lot of historicism around, and that meant people did pay attention to religion and attention to, say, the way that our culture is shaped by Christianity, as Tom Holland has brilliantly insisted, in an accessible way. But nowadays, humanities are dying, and history is dying. Mm. You know, in most of our universities, most students cannot understand anything other than the contemporary. Mm. You know, and that they're allowed often to get away with this. You know, not to read any novels written before yesterday. You know, and then we get a pseudo left. Yeah, not a real left. Not even a real Marxist left, saying, well, you shouldn't read these bad books of the past because they're written by racists, sexists, you know, homophobes, and so forth, you know. And this is so utterly unlike, you know, the university world in which I grew up, in which, you know, higher education was virtually free. Working class people flocked in. They wanted to learn. They said, we are now going to be allowed to read these books, get to know this history. It's no longer the domain of the elite. It's as if a contemporary so-called liberal left is betraying that outlook. Mm. And sort of once again handing things over to an elite, but this will be a new sort of rightist elite, you know, trying to sort of capture culture, maybe, you know, for their own purposes. So in many ways, it looks as if now our problem is that, you know, humanities are dying, and what else can we do but maybe craft Christian or interreligious institutions, educative institutions that will be a haven for this? You know, sort of not kind of places where you're trying to, you know, simply instill your own religious vision, but you're giving people, you're offering something to people. You're saying, here is the legacy, and by all means, you know, let's broaden this out globally. Let's explore further the question of the Eurasian. You know, this doesn't have to be fuddy-duddy. This, we can renew this in a genuinely radical way that does escape from cultural prejudices. We can do that. But the task is I think so enormous, and it's become like one of crafting a counterculture. But we do have people, we do have homes, we do have the computers we're on, we do have the internet. Maybe some of this can be done with relatively small resources. I don't know. Yeah. You know, of many things seem to work nowadays by having things online and then sometimes having sort of real-time meetings, and it may not be perfect. And I tend to think that, you know, institutional real-time education is really important, but you know, compromise may be somewhat inevitable there. I don't know really what the answers are, but I do think we have to think about all this, and you know, having a political impact may be a long way down the line. We may have to think about this cultural formation area first, because to repeat what I've already said, I think, you know, most people want something more economically radical and culturally conservative. And yet it seems almost, I mean, we've got in Britain the rump of the Social Democratic Party then that represents that. But, you know, they're not breaking through into big time politics.
Yeah. That resonates with me a lot, because where I think I've landed is that culture is really where the concerned Christian should be focused, because I just don't see how we can get any traction in politics. And how do you even sell the vision you began the show with, for example, in today's politics obsessed with money, pragmatics, ideology, partisanship, power? I think you've got to go back to culture, and that brings education into the picture, like you're saying. In a way, this is what I'm trying, what I aspire to do with the podcast, by using one of the modern mediums.
Yeah,
and just it's a very offering good offering longer form intellectual conversations, because this is, you've got to meet people where they consume their information, and a lot of people find university rubbish these days. That's probably one reason why humanities is dying, because I think
it's becoming a scam for a lot of people, a huge amount of money for very little received.
And I think, like, that politicization point you made earlier has affected the humanities. So now you go study literature, what you're really studying is some form of feminism or some form of systemic racism through the novels of someone who had never heard of the term.
It's stopped being literary criticism or even literary theory and become just a box-ticking exercise.
Yeah, yeah. This was a point John Carroll made to me on the podcast, who's a prominent sociologist in Australia. And his view was, yes, they're dying, but these courses are crap now. You just get this uninteresting, boring, ideological crap from the kind of pulpit. And kids are thirsty for... At that age, when you're in your early 20s, you're learning, you're thirsty for, you want to stimulate the mind. And instead, you're just told this great novel is just about racism. And that might be a legitimate way to look at it. But you're not giving them that well-rounded education. You're giving them this really narrow tool. You're not equipping them. Yeah.
It's appalling. And then I think, you know, the opposite danger is you then get something like Ralston College that may be trying to do some good things, but is like heavily politicized, you know, it's heavily representing one political ideology.
Yeah.
And this isn't what we want.
No, it's not. John, in the time remaining, because this system actually runs out of time we're recording on, believe it or not. But I did want to just ask a question about theology and social theory, because such an interesting book, and I really think it was seminal. It's now 33 years old, and it's really rare to get an opportunity to speak to an author and look back. And I'd love to know, as the author, what you think of its reception and its journey and its impact over 33 years.
Well, I'm amazed in a way that it and that it has had such an impact. But of course, I'm totally gratified by that, and you know, absolutely delighted. And I suppose by now I've kind of lost track of all the secondary literature concerning it.
It's got beyond you. You can't even keep up with it. That must be a weird feeling as an author, where you can't even stay on top of the secondary literature.
I think a general comment would be that there are some very good people who see the details, but sometimes there are themes in it. I don't know, that still get neglected, and you know. Too often, I think it can be perhaps travestied. But in general, I think that compared to when I wrote, that sort of a dogmatically scientific approach to sociology, for example, is no longer quite so apparent, you know, that the whole thing has become a great deal looser. But I think, you know, the need to do the kind of thing I was suggesting in other parallel areas continues. You know, for example, I think we need a much more critical theological investigation of psychology, you know, and the history of psychology and the way originally religious discourses of the soul, about the soul, have become secularized. You know, there are fragments of that here and there, but that could perhaps be done more systematically. And similarly, the question of the relationship of theology to philosophy and theology to natural science. And, you know, I've tried to follow up with all those things, but probably not enough. So that there's a sense which theology and social theory sort of sets an agenda, if you like, a vast research program, which I think people have to some degree taken up, but could certainly be taken a lot further.
Yeah. Fascinating. John, I'm really grateful for the conversation, thoroughly engrossing and stimulating, and I really thank you for doing it with me.
Well, no, thank you very much indeed. Thank you.
Well, folks, if you enjoyed what you heard here, be sure to subscribe or follow, throw a like, or well, not a like, but a 5-star rating on Apple and or Spotify. Shout out to my producer, Angelo Groza, and I'll catch you next time. Thanks for listening.